Hey, welcome back to another episode of UAP Studies. My name is Jason Gilmet, and I'm joined by Michael Glosson. How's it going, Michael?
Doing great, Jason. How are you, man?
Do you know what? Not bad. We just had a meeting with our boy Sage, and it's good morning so far. I'm really pumped with the new rebranding of the podcast happening in mid-October. This should be released in October by that point. We're also working on some Patreon as well, some content for Patreon, and we're going to really load up Patreon as much as we can with things.
That's exciting.
Yeah, I know. And you being part of the scientific coalition of UAP studies and just being in the academic world, your contributions to what you're writing, what you can educate us on is going to be freaking phenomenal. And yeah, we're just going to create content on even how to investigate video content quite a bit. We're going to start doing that too. Going out in the field and investigating things in my region just to show people how it's done and how to handle it as best as I understand the investigated process so far. So yeah, it's going to be cool and a lot more information. I want to post even some drawings of different species and other what we know so far based on the information given to us and what we've learned from the podcast. So it's really good. I'm excited about it. It gives me more to do in relation to the podcast. And seriously, Michael, you coming on the team and, you know, having Sage on the team is just solid.
I'm glad to be here. I mean, I feel like we are kind of come at it from two so radically different angles. You have so much personal experience with the phenomenon and I don't, but I have this sort of weird broad coalition of voices that I can pull from and other people who have their own experience. So I think it's a lot of interesting content coming.
Yeah. And it's as much as we can on the podcast, it's not biased. It's, you know, obviously we're going to have our biases and things that you can't prevent that in human nature, but it's about presenting the information as neutral as we can. And say, hey, you make your decision whether you believe in this guy or you don't, or this case or you don't. Here's the information on it. So at least you're educated. I think that's the problem today. So some people will just focus on one point of the phenomenon and they forget to look at the overall picture. And that's important, right? Somebody mentioned
ties in with what we're doing today, because you've got a whole stack of books from very different perspectives, and I brought a few of my own to recommend. So maybe that'll kind of round out some of the perspectives that the viewers can check out if they're interested in it.
Absolutely. And these books, it's books that we have read that from cover to cover and that we recommend because they've enlightened us or maybe opened us up to some new ideas and concept in ufology that we didn't have before, which is important. You got to educate yourself when it comes down to this. And it's a multitude of disciplines that are involved in this. So, you know, read as much as you can. But before we get started, I just want to mention we are, because we are rebranding, there's a new YouTube channel. There is going to be a Rumble channel as well. We're trying to get back on Apple Podcasts. I know that we're not on there right now. And in Patreon. So we're going to get a lot more active in these areas. We're going to add the links to the new YouTube channel at the bottom of this episode as well. And whenever we come up with new, whenever we end up on some other platform, we'll keep the audience, of course, engaged. But I just want to mention that to the listeners that haven't seen the podcast in a while, just because we've been rebranding Louis Zexit. It was just a bit too fast and we didn't get time to adjust, but we are adjusting now and we're back on track. So, Michael, without further ado, let's get into our books review, man.
Let's do it. You want to take yours first and then I'll go after?
Sure. You know what? I was deciding what order I was going to do, but you know what I'm going to do is I'm going to grab the big one first. Okay, my first recommendation is actually not so much UAP related, but it is The Brief History of Time by Stephen Hawking and Universe in a Nutshell. You don't need to be a physicist or understand much about science on this. He was brilliant in the way he would describe things and explain it. You know, it's hard to do that visually. And when you read, it's hard to explain something, but somehow he managed to do it. The more knowledge we understand about our universe, the more it makes sense about extra dimensions or extraterrestrials, because you get a broader understanding of how big the universe is, how complex it is, and maybe how full of life it is as well, right? And it's just you got to keep in mind, this is the science that we understand at this time in 2023. Yeah. It's bound to change as we discover the world. And he leaves that open in the book that we're going to discover other stuff. It's not, this is just what we know so far. They're all theories, right? But I definitely recommend this just as a starter point, especially if you get into UFOs. It's a bit of a read. I'm not going to lie to you, but it's well worth it, because then anything else you go into, you have at least a scientific understanding or a basic understanding of how the universe works. And that's really cool. So that's my first book recommendation.
Can I tell you my encounter story with Stephen Hawking's book?
Absolutely.
So when I was in high school, I thought I fancied myself a smart person, and I had bought that book. But like all people who like books, I have the problem that the rate at which I buy books is so much greater than the rate at which I read books.
Welcome to the club. Yeah.
Yeah. So I have tons of books I've never read, which I think is a good thing, because I can just walk into my room and I have a library to choose from. So whenever I want to read a new book, I don't think there's anything wrong with that anymore. But there was a girl that I liked in high school. I think I was in, this was in my junior year. There was a girl that I liked, and she saw that book in my room, and I was like, oh yeah, you know, I'm just reading a little Stephen Hawking, no big deal, like trying to act all nonchalant about it. I was like, oh, you should really read it. And she went and read it, and I hadn't. And then I had to fake my way through a few conversations about Stephen Hawking before I actually went and read the thing. But that was a moment of humility for me, I think. But it is a great book, and he's an excellent writer, which is super ironic since he can't move anything below his like eyeballs at the time that he was writing the book. But I totally agree with that recommendation.
And it's crazy too, because you would think, you know, he's just sitting in a chair. I think his ex-wife said that he would just be sitting in a chair, everybody else is in the other room like a party, and he's just sitting alone in the room. And he's like, oh, he must be bored. Mm-mm. He's like contemplating the universe, and he's living out there, mm-hmm. which is amazing. Like you mentioned, just the fact he's able to write so amazingly to simplify things for us.
Yeah.
That's a sign of intelligence, right? Just knowing like, okay, I know you don't know much about this. Let's simplify it for you, right?
And he's great at that. That's why he occupies the same teaching chair that Isaac Newton occupied in his university. So it's a fitting place for him to have landed before he finally passed on to whatever comes after this. But
absolutely,
yeah, Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, so that's my first book recommendation. Start with the universe. Yeah.
What's number two for you?
This freaking book.
Whitley Strieber. That no book has scared me much
as this cover.
Communion. Yeah. the cover.
F you to whoever painted this. You know what I mean? Like, you traumatized my childhood. This was scarier than any movie that I've ever seen. Just this book cover. But you know what? I used to, when I was a kid, I used to go to the library and I would take out books on UFOs all the time. I could never take out this book. It creeped me out. I took it out once and I had to put it on its face in the closet. I'm not kidding you. I was that terrified away, and I never read it. I just kept boring the book, and I'm like, why am I creeping myself out with this?
When did you finally read it?
About 4 years ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. 4 years ago, I was able to do that. See, I've been obsessed with this phenomenon as you know, ever since I was a kid. I was always terrified to go to sleep at night, right? Always had to. I had my twin brother who made me comfortable, but I would always like look at the window. It's like, why do I do this to myself, right? I would watch these. It's a kid watching scary stories and then trying to go to bed. That's pretty much what it was. But this book specifically, because he talks about, you know, he's laying in bed and all of a sudden stuff happens, creeps me out, right? Because it's creepy. If you're in bed and you're defenseless, that's the worst time for anything to happen, and that's when they show up. But it's a great book, as complicated as the story is, because things sometimes don't make sense in the alien abduction, which makes sense because it's alien to us. There's no point of reference. But the part that for me in the book was really cool was he was talking about an incident that he kind of vaguely remembers, but it was military people that were also like on a hypnosis on these tables, and he had noticed there was like a lot of them, and he asked like, what are they doing here? And they said, well, they were just in the forest, we just picked them up. Like, they were probably on a training exercise, and then these guys just show up and take them, and these army men have no idea, they're all knocked out. That scared me more, because it's like you could try to plan around, you know, avoiding this, but if they come, they come. That's it. There's no, can't fight it. They just shut you off. And this is what the book scared me off the most, was that, you know, you just talked about his son in his room at night, and there's nothing you could do to prevent your kids from being taken. Nothing as a parent. And that's scary as hell, right?
Especially to be powerless in front of something, in front of
absolutely.
Something.
And who knows, like, how far back it goes back in the lineage, but obviously there has something to do with your offspring and the people before you, like genetically, they're almost just following the family along. So this was a huge one when it came out. I think it was in the 80s when it came out. And to be honest, what we remember or what we know now about alien probes and, you know, the laughing stock of aliens coming here and shoving stuff up our butts came from this book.
Yeah.
Because when they inserted a rod, when he went to the doctor, I think it was 2 days later, he said, "This, your body's showing signs of rape. Like something clearly happened," and it became a laughing stock, and that's what people ran with. But it came from this book. Highly recommend it. As scary as the book cover is, you could always tear it off, but just read the book. It's a great starting point in the alien abduction phenomenon and how weird it is to the individual. So that's my second book.
So before you move on, you had Whitley on the program before I ever came onto it. Was it weird to meet the person who had been responsible for scaring you so bad?
It was an honor. It was an honor, to tell the truth. You know, doing this podcast, again, to talk with people, even like Calvin Parker and stuff like that, just people have famous cases, and to be able to talk with them and get that genuine conversation with them, to get to ask somebody questions that you've always wanted to ask, because, you know, you see them on TV or see them on other programs, but you get a general sense of, like, you know what, this guy really went through this. And again, the alien abduction is millions of people globally. So either it's really happening, or these people are mentally ill. And it's a new mental illness that nobody's diagnosed yet.
Oh yeah. Right? It's something, whatever it is, it's something really.
Yeah, difficult. It can't be in between, Michael. Yeah, it can't be in between.
The thing that freaked me out about, not really freaked me out, but the thing that I found so undeniably interesting about Communion as a book is, so I read it and I thought it's super scary. If even if it were just a piece of horror fiction, it would be excellent.
Yeah.
It's also written, I have one note in my copy of the book where I remember writing, if I wanted to teach a class in how to write in such a way that people automatically believe that you were telling them the truth, I would give them this book. Because he writes in such a sensory way,
he's humble.
He's like so self. Like he'll throw in embarrassing details about himself. I mean, he's not trying to make himself look good or whatever, and it comes across as extremely compelling. Mm. But the thing that I thought was so fascinating is that I found out later that after he had a friend paint the alien for the cover of the book according to his own memory, sort of like, you know, we do with like crime sketches or whatever. You kind of describe something to a person, they paint it. And then he saw it and he was like, okay, that's the version that's really good. We'll put that on the cover. Well, and we'll publish it. And then after he published it is when he started getting thousands and thousands of letters of people saying, I've seen this very thing. Nobody had seen this, what is now like a standard, like bumper sticker illustration of an alien. Nobody had ever seen one of these until Whitley Strieber, you know, produced, or nobody had seen a depiction of it until Whitley Strieber's book came out. And then when it did, he got so many letters. He said that he and his wife stopped counting at 500,000 letters that they had gotten from people who said that they experienced this, which makes me wonder how many other sorts of experiences are there out there that we just need our Whitley Strieber sort of tipping point moment where like everybody sees the illustration. They're like, oh, I've seen that thing too. And now we have 500,000 people just in America writing him saying like, I've seen this thing. I think that is just it's bizarre to be able to trace such a common phenomenon down to a single source.
Yeah. And you don't get the ball going too, because at the time, and he does mention this, Bud Hopkins and John Mack were working on this. Bud Hopkins introduced John Mack to the concept or the idea that John Mack thought it was absolutely ridiculous. But the more he investigated, the more he's like, these people don't know each other, and he would travel the world and they tell the same story or the same detail and events, which is phenomenal because it's happening globally. And we're not talking about it because how do you talk about something that's not accepted in society amongst us humans? Think you and I are more like, I love philosophy. I just love the idea. I don't know all my, the philosophy ideas out there, but I love the idea to be able to think and reflect, especially nowadays too. Like, I don't know if you noticed recently, but on Twitter or X now, as it's called, there's so much information coming out and a lot of it is false. The Mexico UFO disclosure that just took place, you know, September, horrible.
I don't know if we'd call it a disclosure. You mean the alien bodies, the little Muppet.
To me, it was a circus. The way they ran it, and even Ryan Graves was like, I apologize for going there because that was a big setback. You know, I was
He didn't know that this was good. I guess he's apologizing for being involved in it, you know, post hoc, but he didn't know that this was going to turn into a joke.
I think he thought it was going to be like the Congress hearings, a little bit more serious and stuff like that. Not so much like, you know, now showing contestant number two, and even the little figures that he has. I'm going to talk to Steve Mara, who had really investigated this. He's like, those are fake. Like, it's been proven fake. He thought they were real too, right? They built so much hype about how they found it in the caves and, you know, authentic, and let's do DNA. It's always on the fence. The people like, it's most likely fake. And I've never heard of aliens this tall. You know, I've never heard, like, I woke up in the middle of the night and there's a one foot tall creature. Yeah. Have you controlled me? Like, I've never heard of that. So again, I'm not saying it can't be real. I'm just saying it was a setback.
You know, my thought was that when I saw them, I thought if a UFO landed in my backyard and those things walked out, I would think, damn it, I can never show these to anybody because they look so stupidly fake.
Yeah.
That like nobody would ever believe it, even if they were real. So even if those things were real, the rollout shouldn't have been like unveiling. Look at how just bizarre and Muppet like these things look. It should have been like, Here's tissue samples and here's our forensic reports on them. And then eventually you can show the whole thing. But like just unveiling something that looks so silly is only going to look silly. Now, even if it were real, it would just still look so silly.
But it is part of, unfortunately, ufologies that you got to take all of it in and then discern what's real, what's fake. And obviously there's going to be a lot of fake stuff. And it's hard now, because everything's all over the place. You have to focus and pay attention to the details that make sense and those that don't, that could be just put aside for the time being because it's not relevant. Don't dismiss it. It's just not relevant to the current situation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the alien abduction for me, phenomenon globally, you know, even the interaction with orbs that seem to be global. There's something definitely going on, and Whitley was brave enough to step up in the 80s and just put the cards on the table. Because back then, even Bud Hopkins, like, they had secret sessions with these people. These people did not want to come forward with it. And as far as I'm concerned, he's like the only author to come forward and say, hey, you know what? I may not know a lot about UFOs, but I wake up in the middle of the night and I have strange creatures that take me on a, you know, journey or an experiment or whatever. So that to me, I highly encourage Communion as a starter base to at least understand kind of what the abduction is and how weird it is to the experiencer. And Whitley does not shy away from describing the weirdness and the unexplained that he can't, you know, can't rationalize. So he just tells you, I can't rationalize this.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Make the best of it. Right. Great. Yeah. Great way to start and to be humble. Let's get to one of your books, man.
Okay. So where to start? Maybe a good place to start is where I started. Book that compelled me to take the phenomenon seriously. This is American Cosmic by Diana Walsh DeSulca. So I came to this book because when you're a teacher, you get these catalogs from university presses saying, like, here's our books, tell us which ones you want to look at, and we'll send you some in hopes that you'll like get your students to buy them for your courses or whatever, right? And so I was flipping through Oxford University Press. They have a great press. Their books are always excellent. I was flipping through their catalog, and I came across this book. And the subtitle of the book is UFOs, Religion, Technology. And I thought, Oxford published a book on UFOs? Like, yes, please send me this. Like, I don't know how I'll ever use this in the course, but like, I want to read Oxford's UFO book. And I got it. And then I spent the next like 5 days by my pool reading this book. And it was the most bizarre encounter I've ever had with a piece of nonfiction, I think. Maybe subsequently I've read weirder things, but it, the effect on me was so bizarre, because what she does is she starts out by saying, she starts out sort of talking my language as an academic by saying that she says, I don't know what I believe about these things. My job isn't to make any pronouncement about what's true or not. But what I'm going to do in this book is I'm going to take you along with people who do believe, and not just like weird UFO cult people who are interesting and deserve to be studied in their own right or whatever. But I'm going to take you along with some especially unusual specimens of people that I didn't think existed. And then the first chapter, she takes you, she introduces you to a person that she calls Tyler D. Tyler D, we now know, is Timothy Taylor, who's a NASA engineer. And well, he's not employed by NASA. He has contracts with NASA, but he's a biotechnologist. He's got a PhD in some sort of like molecular engineering or chemistry or something, but totally a legit scientist. But she calls him Tyler D for reasons that become really interesting, something to do with the movie Fight Club that then becomes like a weird synchronicity later in the book.
Oh, Tyler Durden. Yeah, I can see that.
Yeah. And this guy basically is a billionaire who tells her, like, I have gotten almost all my ideas for these incredible inventions that I have, these biotechnologies, because I downloaded them straight from some sort of extraterrestrial source. And I know you don't believe that, but I'm going to take you somewhere and I'm going to show you something. So he has her put on a blindfold and get on his private jet. And he takes her out into the middle of the desert somewhere. And he's like, this is where a UFO crashed. Let's see if we can find some stuff. And he just sort of leaves her on her own to like gallivant around in the desert, I guess.
This is the writer, Diane, is the one?
Diana Pasulke, yeah.
Okay, gotcha.
She eventually finds, you know, a boulder in like a crevice, and there's like some old degraded like cans or something there. Like, it hasn't been disturbed in a really long time. And she digs it out and she finds a strange piece of metal that she describes as, it's like metallic, but it has the texture of, she said, frog skin. I'm not really sure what that means. Maybe I'm not as familiar with frogs as she is.
Yeah.
But they eventually get it analyzed, and it's got some interesting metamaterial properties or something. And she thinks, oh, have I been set up here? This is kind of weird, but also I'm intrigued, right? And in the second chapter, she introduces you to somebody else, somebody that she calls James, who in the end turns out to be a person you've had on the podcast before I joined, Dr. Gary Nolan.
Nice.
And Gary Nolan is a real deal experiencer now. He's very public about that. He's a scientist at Stanford Med. And he talks about his own experiences and this background that he has doing scientific research on things like fighter pilots who've had encounters with UAP, and it's changed this part of their brain called the caudate putamen that, you know, has a bunch of, after their encounters, they end up having like far more connectivity in this area than a normal person would. And it allows for like hyper fast intuitive responses. Like if you're playing chess, you can, you know, people who are like chess grandmasters have tons of connectivity in the caudate putamen. And after you have these encounters, some of these fighter pilots have that level of connectivity too. So all sorts of weird stuff. It goes on and on, and she does some film analysis. It's just like kind of all over the place, but in a really rich and interesting way. She does a reading of 2001: A Space Odyssey and talks about how our own concepts of technology that we've filtered through fiction might actually be affecting the phenomena that we experience ourselves. It might just might be like half projection, half like a sort of blending of, we're actually experiencing a phenomenon, but like our conceptions of phenomena also help shape it in a way.
Oh yeah. That's a good way to look at it.
Yeah. It's this really rich source of ideas and mostly ideas that I'd never come across before. And I haven't come across since in most UFO or UAP related books. So even though this was my entry, I still really highly recommend this book to people who've been into the phenomenon for a long time, because it's not your standard UAP book. I think if I had first come to a normal UAP book like Communion first, I don't know that I ever would have been like really hooked by that. And I would have thought it was an interesting story and he's an interesting person. But this, for me, is what it took to get me to say, maybe there's really a there there. And so when I got done reading, I started looking at the citations and started ordering books that she had cited. And another one of these is one of those books. But I want to go back to one of yours. You have more than I do now.
No, well, if that was the end of that, but that's definitely one that is not on. I don't have that yet, so I need to get that book. I love going to used bookstore. We have a really great one in my town here. It's the largest used bookstore in Western Canada, and I love browsing their like mysterious books. But what I find funny is that you'll go to the UFO section, and it's the same section as palm reading, ghosts, the book. Sellers have a hard time taking it seriously. It might as well be in a comic book section, right? When I go there, I hold my head up high, I'll bring a stack of books on UFOs, put it on there, like I'm the buyer, so keep buying these books because I'll come buy them from you. But yeah, no, you know what, you also land on gems. I mean, there's so many books that's written on this phenomenon. I didn't know that. Like, there's so many authors, different perspectives, different people coming out. Like, there's so much to it. And you realize that this phenomenon is ingrained in every aspect of your life as an individual, from food to your thoughts to your place in the universe. Like, it makes you rethink it. I would love to see what Aristotle and Socrates would make of acknowledging this phenomenon. And, you know, because we're still trying to figure out ourselves as humans, and that's what philosophy and patience and virtues, that's it. But when you're dealing, okay, well, there's us and then there's non-human entities, what does that do our philosophy, right? Because now their philosophy will leak onto ours, right? We'll start and it's the same thing. Like, you know, people think, well, you know, in the Bible, Jesus was so original with his ideas and concept. Well, he didn't steal those concepts. Those concepts were already around because the Romans were obsessed with the Greek philosophers, and they taught wherever they were the Greek philosophy, and that leaked into religion. And eventually you have the New Testament because of that. They're all, you know, give your shirt off your back to another person, treat somebody well, what's your place within. It's all from philosophy. So it's not, you know, even our morals and integrity comes from philosophy. It's come from self-reflection, right? Sure. And that's what, for me, I think, you know, science and philosophy, and I mentioned that to you before, needs to come together, because this is what's needed to progress now to the next level. It's no longer a deviation of it. Even bringing in spirituality in the mix, have the three going, and we might find out something that we don't know, right? If we're afraid to venture in that section, we're never going to discover anything, right? My next book suggestion.
Bring it.
I know you and I differ on Bob Lazar, but Dreamland was written by Bob Lazar. George Knapp basically does a foreword for the book. Mm-hmm. George Knapp, in the beginning of the book, describes the fight that him and Bob Lazar had at the news station, because they were in the room and they were going to play the tape, and George had the tape, and Bob changed his mind last minute. Like, you can't show that. The original tape that came out in 89. And George's like, no, we got to show it. We got to show it. And they start wrestling each other in the room. I laughed because I had never heard of that story before. Right. But George just says, this is what happened. We were struggling. And then George grabbed the tape and he sat down in the chairs right away. Go, hey, and he started the program. They were literally just fighting. But the issue with Bob Lazar is, I think when people question him, it's not sequential. So they'll ask him questions that took place at different times. And of course, we all know this. Like, try to remember something that took place 30 years ago. The details are murky. You can't, you know, things change over time. Every time that you remember a memory, you alter it every single time, right? So eventually 20 years, 30 years down the road, the actual event is different in your mind. Different things happen because you altered it and you just don't know. But in this book, he lays it out, basically his start, how we got approached, because he was looking for a job. We interviewed Jim Goodall, who said that when he met Lazar right before he got the job, but he had the job at S4, but hadn't started yet. And Bob could not tolerate UFOs or aliens. He thought it was absolute nonsense. You're a quack to believe it, until he works at S4. And then he's like, holy shit, these things are real. He mentioned 9 crafts that were working on the hangar. We had other people like, I think it was John Lear. He mentioned something along the lines of 9 to 12 crafts. Now we have Grush coming out saying they have up to 12 crafts. So the government has crafts. And this is the U.S. government. We're not even including all the other countries. But he explains how he messed up because he was young. He was scared out of his wits. You know, the phones were being tapped and all that. Ultimately, his demise was that his wife was having an affair with a flight pilot that she was taking lessons from. And the people from S4 knew of the event, but they stopped calling him in because they thought this was going to, you know, he's going to have to deal with shit at home. He thought his life was in danger because he had heard about the Russians working on S4. They went missing. His handler, I think his name was Dennis, which he ended up using his name when he came out as the covert name Dennis, handed him a gun and said, you might need this. So shit got real for him really fast, too soon, too. Like, they kept flying him out at different times, 2 a.m. from Las Vegas, or 3 a.m., like just weird times. And then it would keep him on base for a while. But he describes, like, his whole thought process, like he couldn't wrap his head around the fact that the government had this stuff. And it's good because it goes from start to finish and explains the story in full detail, which I think is the better way to learn Bob Lazar's story. Sure. Learning it out of sequence, it doesn't make sense. It's not sequential. You can't make heads or tails of it. But he does a really good job writing as well, which I was really impressed by. He's a smart guy. I'm a huge Bob Lazar fan. He got me into UFOs in 1989 before I even had a sighting. And I believe him. From the get-go, 1989 to now, I still believe him. I think the guy was spot on. Is every detail accurate? No, because people are infallible. Like, we make mistakes. He admits to his mistakes. He goes, I fucked up here, fucked up there. Dude, that's an honest man, right? An honest man will admit his mistakes. Again, people are on the fence with Bob Lazar. We might get some comments of people like, Jason, you're out to lunch, but I recommend that book. That's my book.
Is that his first book?
Yeah, I think it's his first book. Yeah, Dreamland.
That's the book that got. That's the book that hooked you. Like you said, that Bob Lazar hooked you. Was it through the book or was it?
No, it was. Interview? It's 1989. My dad was obsessed. Like that day, he's like, "Oh, they're going to come out with some UFO news. They're announcing it because it had gone global. Canada hadn't quite caught up. I think it was a day or so after. But when it went globally, I remember sitting down, I'm sweating. I don't even think I had a shirt on. I was like 9 years old. I'm watching the TV and then, you know, Dennis comes on the screen and he's all highlighted. But just what he was saying, I'm like, I believe him. Like, why would somebody risk their life? You know, they're because they feel that they're going to get whacked. They have no choice, right? This is a desperate move. And since then, I'm like, there's no way the government doesn't have that. And then, of course, having my encounter when I was 13, locked it in, solidified it for me. This guy's telling the truth, right? There's no way he's not. If I had not had that experience, I probably would be on the fence. But definitely, I 100% believe him, right? So call me wrong if you want to, audience. You're allowed to. But for me, I'm a Bob Lazar believer.
Well, I'm still skeptical, but not educated enough to have an informed opinion. I have not yet read Bob Lazar's book, and I plan to. I did order it. It is here somewhere.
It's but too bad you don't live too close to me. I would just lend it to you. But yeah, you're at a
well. I treat my books pretty rough, so I don't know if you'd want to lend me.
I like my books pristine. Yeah, yeah. But you know, that being said, I do highlight them and I tag them and stuff. It's just I'm not one of those dog ear benders, you know. For the pages.
I'm not a dog ear.
No. You're not cruel. You're not cruel.
Not a monster, but like, look at that. That's fairly normal.
And that means that you went through the book, right? That you've actually enjoyed and you studied it, and that's the point of it, right? Yeah, let's get to your second book, Michael.
Okay, my turn again. So I'll go with this book, which I got out of the notes from Dr. Pasulka's book. This is Passport to Magonia by Jacques Vallée. He was, I think, your 100th guest on the podcast.
He was. That was amazing. Yeah.
An excellent choice for 100th guest. But I want to read you a short excerpt from, let's see, where did I mark it? At one point, he explains who he wrote this book for and why. And you can find that because it's on. He's here, he says. It's on page 156. He says, the problem, he means the problem of UFOs and what they are and all that, problem can't be solved today. If we absolutely must have something to believe, then we should join one of the numerous groups of people who have all the answers. Read the Condon Report, or subscribe to the magazines that prove that flying saucers are real and from outer space. I have not written this book for such people. But for those few who have gone through all this and have graduated to a higher, clearer level of perception of the total meaning of that tenuous dream that underlies the many nightmares of human history. For those who have recognized within themselves and in others the delicate levers of imagination and will not be afraid to experiment with them. That's some lofty language for a book about UFOs. And he gets a little lofty sometimes, but I really appreciate the fact that he writes a book about UFOs and says, I don't know what UFOs are. I don't have an answer to this. What I have for you in this book is hundreds and hundreds of accounts of what we would call UFOs today, but he's taken from all sorts of other traditions like Celtic fairy lore and Egyptian mythology and biblical stories and medieval weather manuals and all sorts of like places that you don't think of as UFOs. But the central argument of his book is, if you look at all of these strange things that have happened over history that people have been puzzled by, so many of them fit what we would today call a UFO experience. That we forced to say that this is not a phenomenon that started when, you know, Kenneth Arnold saw some flying saucers in 1947 or
45? Oh God, the we'll fans are gonna kill
me. Somewhere. So it was oh, I think God. It was two years before Roswell. So yeah, 1945 sounds right. It didn't start then. This is a continuation that we've shifted language for. I mean, people used to describe seeing flying houses. Well, I mean, what other language would you use before we had ships right. and buildings made of metal and things like that? You know, people said they saw flying canoes that had wings on them. I mean, if your material world, if a canoe is the closest thing to what you saw, that's what you're going to use, right? Mm. So we need to group all of those things together and study this phenomenon that stretches through religious history and through mythology and through, you know, political history. I mean, we talk about battle histories that have strange events in them. And I was really compelled by it. I was pretty convinced when I came away from this book that at least a really significant proportion of the strange events that you hear in other mythologies probably should be filed under what we call UFOs today.
Nice. And just to correct myself, it's 1947. It was July. Kenneth Arnold was 2 weeks before the Roswell crash. Just
2 weeks. Oh,
just kick that in right now. The reason I said 1945, and I'm not going to go too much into this, but Jacques Vallée and Paula Harris wrote Trinity. 1945 was actually the first crash, not 1947. And it was at the Trinity site right near where they had Big Boy and all that for the bombs they dropped on mm-hmm. Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But there was an avocado-shaped craft with three entities in it that crashed on this land where two little boys, 9 and 7 year old, went to go see what it was, and he saw the three entities. They went inside the craft. They took a treasure, hid it in their home ranch underneath the it was a ranch worker that was living in a ranch home. So they hid it underneath this floorboard. He wakes up in the middle of the night with three entities asking for the treasure. The Thesoro or Tesoro or something like that. And he had no idea what they were talking about. He left the next day. He didn't want to stay there anymore. But interestingly enough, they build a road, the military build a road and got the avocado shaped craft from their land. They didn't ask permission. They just went in. But the boys, it's funny because he talks about it was on the back of a 18-wheeler with a tarp on it. And the little boys, before it went away, decided to go back inside. And it describes there's one survivor left, but there's other testimonies of the other little boy that was there too. And there's just evidence, like they found just really weird stuff. So Trinity is well worth reading. That's why I got my 1945, 1947 wrong, is because this one was the first one. It's really, really good. So sorry, I got my dates wrong there for the listeners. Don't write nasty comments. These guys don't know the date of Roswell.
No, let us know. I'm still learning. So in the comments, let me know what I don't know that I need to know.
And same for me. Tell me. Yeah, we're humble. We know we don't know anything, and that's the way it should be, right?
Yeah, I hope so. I always want to keep learning. Absolutely. And I think our listeners are pretty smart people from the interaction.
Smarter than me, that's for sure. Yeah.
So yeah, send me your reading lists.
Yeah, and we do.
Are you next?
You go ahead. Yeah, go ahead. I just showed you the Trinity one. Yeah.
Well, how many do you have now?
Do you know what I'm gonna do? I'm just gonna do three more really quickly. So. You let me know what you got.
How about you do your three? I only have one left, and it's fiction. So I wanted
to one will actually left. Go with actually two of them are basically related to each other. So I'll do the two of them.
Okay, go for it.
The first one is so I would say The Believer by Ralph Blumenthal.
Yeah,
and Ralph Blumenthal is one of the journalists that broke the story in 2017 about the Nimitz and the Tic Tac UFOs.
The New York Times story.
Yeah, and he's been really adamant on, looking into this a lot more. And he's a serious journalist, like New York Times, award winner, him and his wife. They just came out with a children's book as well, explaining UFOs to kids. Mm. But in this book, it talks about John Mack and his passion for the abductees, his research, his life. He was a messy individual, but he had a good heart. All the way until his untimely death in London when he got hit by a car looking at the wrong side of the road. But he was a pioneer, and he was willing to put his reputation as a Harvard psychiatrist, looking into this phenomenon. And he tried to shut him down, but eventually they turned around and he said, no, he has every right to look into this. And a lot of people, his peers, looked at him like, you're crazy. How could you be looking into this? But if millions of people are accounting for this, and it's a new, let's say, mental illness, he was the first to actually look into it. What solidified it for him, the believer, or John Mack in this case, was the Ariel School in 1994.
Is that Zimbabwe?
Yeah. And there's a fantastic documentary out right now called Ariel, and I highly recommend it for everybody to watch. But him interviewing these kids and finding out, about these, little 4 foot tall creatures, big black eyes, big heads, the way they move, like the kids were traumatized. They saw something that's not human.
Yeah.
And that solidified it for John. And the second book that I would recommend, and this is probably hard to find, but it's by C.D.B. Bryan. And I'll show you the cover here. It's quite
Alien Abduction, UFOs, and the conference
at MIT. So they had a big conference before John Mack died, and they had a bunch of abductees and researchers there, and they all had a chance to go up on stage and talk about their stories. But in this, there's a lot of John Mack goodies because he talks about cases, similarities between it, and just the fact that it's so random. Like, there doesn't seem to be a pattern to these abductions. Even talking with Reverend Michael Carter and our boy Roderick, here's the problem is that the African-American community are not saying anything about it. Yeah. It's not part of the culture. It's frowned upon, but they're experiencing this as much as anybody else, any other culture in the world. And we need more people to speak up. We need the minority that haven't said anything to step up to the plate and say, we're experiencing it too. Because it is, that you listen to these guys' encounters, you're like, why isn't the African-American community talking about this more than they should? Why is it always white people? Even here in Abbotsford, I was talking to a psychiatrist, and she said, we have a lot of Punjabi population where I live. And she says they don't talk about it. It's not part of their culture. It's frowned upon. You're looked at as if you're crazy. And again, it's a stigma in different cultures that we have. We have many cultures, but the stigma of UFO is across all of them. And I think this breaks the boundary of saying there's no more stigma. This is a universal issue. So this book, like I said, it's hard to find. I lucked out at the bookstore because it was there, but this is an amazing conference. A lot of great insight on just the UFOs. There's stuff from Stanton Friedman in it. So a lot of good stuff. And this writer is very well respected. So for him to look into this and write a book about it, freaking A. So
I think the thing that that I found compelling about John Mack's research, and what seemed to compel him too, is that conclusion that there's nothing that all of these people have in common apart from the fact that they claim this really bizarre experience. Like, he was expecting to come in and find like some similar personality profile, or find that they'd all had some similar kind of childhood trauma or something that could explain it. There's just nothing that seemed that, at least in his view, seemed to explain the common and very strange reports that these people were having, other than the fact that they say that it happened. I mean, they were upstanding citizens, many of them, or, you know, were, had good professional lives or whatever. I mean, and it's just not what he expected. And I think that is compelling to me and seems to be what compelled him to risk his career so thoroughly. And it was a real risk too, because he got the very first investigation Harvard Medical School faculty ever launched against one of its own faculty members was against John Mack, and he was eventually exonerated for it. But yeah, what a story, what a life.
And what a pioneer and a man, like, to be able to go through that, like, alone. You're handling all the punches, all the criticism, right? Because you're standing out of the crowd. And like I said, those are people to emulate. Leslie Kane and, Linda Moulton Howe, like, man, they've been at it for so long. They've received so many nasty things, or had to live through nasty things and reputation and all that, all on something that's probably proven to be exactly true, that it is happening. And they've been calling this or blowing the whistle for years. So yeah, no, man, I'm on board too. Like, John Mack, Bud Hopkins, like, pioneers. Absolutely. Let's get to your other book.
All right. So my last one is, I wanted to pick a fiction book. And the reason is that I feel like, and this is surprising to me when I came into the UFO community, is that almost nobody talks about science fiction. And in my experience, science fiction writers are some of the best thinkers about the possibilities for what extraterrestrial life and contact scenarios might look like. And I think if I had to pick one sci-fi writer that I would suggest everybody read to think better about extraterrestrial life and its possibilities, it would probably be Stanislaw Lem. And the place that I would start is his book, Solaris. This has an unfortunate cover because it's really hard to get original prints.
It's a romance.
Of it. Yeah. So this makes it look like this is a romance story about George Clooney. But this is a still from the, this is a still pick from the Steven Soderbergh 2002 remake, which I totally recommend you watch, but I don't recommend you watch it as a way to understand Solaris, because it's just not about this novel at all. It's
It's very, its own very thing.
Based on it. Yeah. It's its own thing, and it's a wonderful movie in that right. But it does not do what this book does in any way. Solaris is no real plot spoilers here. I'll just give you like the bare bones of the plot for people who don't know and who might want to be enticed a bit by it. Solaris is the name of a planet, sort of. It's a unique kind of planet that's been discovered because it has a surface that's solid, but it's highly luminous for some reason we don't understand. And so humanity has built a space station around the planet to study it, mostly to see whether it's a viable source of energy.
Right.
And the crew of people on this this space station start experiencing really bizarre things that at first seem purely psychological in nature, right? And eventually they need the help of a psychologist to help them sort through what's going on. And that's kind of all I want to say about the plot. But what makes the novel so worth reading is that Stanislaw Lem does such a fantastic job of thinking about how alien life might be. I mean, truly alien. We imagine aliens in Hollywood movies as basically being humans that are just ugly and slimy, right?
Reflection of ourselves, right?
Yeah. You know, it's basically a human that just has like more teeth or something. And that's not how I imagine alien life will probably be. I mean, the vast majority of alien life probably doesn't resemble us at all. The vast majority of life on Earth doesn't resemble us at all. So why would it be any better out there? Good point. And the ways that life could evolve, there's like an infinite number. And so Stanislaw Lem's trying to put forward this argument that if we find alien life, we might not ever be able to really communicate with it, because their bodies, the way their minds work, the way they manipulate symbols in their mind to derive and transmit meaning, sort of the way we use letters and sounds and stuff, they might do it in such a totally different way from us that there's no way, no matter how hard we try, to fit those two things together. It's like you've got, you know, them over here and us over here, and you've got to build something that kind of translates everything.
It's complete opposites. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe not just too hard, but like literally impossible. And in the book Solaris, what he does is he presents you with what seems like an alien life form that really wants to communicate, and we really want to communicate with it, and both sides try their damnedest, and it's not easy, I'll say. And the ways that it's not easy, I think, are beautiful and interesting, and he's a great writer, but in the end it makes you think that this is a real practical problem that we'll need to solve one day, and it might be that there just is no solution.
And you know, our future is complex, as I was. If we're able to survive, our future's in the stars. We need to start being starfaring people. We need to start expanding the way that we are living now. It's leading us to that. We need to go off world. It's going to expand our understanding and broadening of the universe, but also allow us to treat each other better, because we understand how much space there is out there, how special Earth is, because that's where everybody, you know, all the history, everything took place on that tiny little dot, just like Carl Sagan said, right? And it's significant. We need to be out there. I think that's the progress, natural progress of intelligent life, is to seed out from their own planet and become more active in the universe at large. If, you know, even in our small quadrant of the, you know, galaxy that we're at, you know, and that's always amazing to me. I'll go look at the stars, and you look at this plethora of freaking stars. That's just the stars in our little area of the galaxy.
One galaxy, yeah.
Isn't that crazy? So yeah, it blows my mind. And I think that's where our future is. That's where our resources are. I think it will push the boundaries of human evolution, because you will evolve different on a different planet, because of the resources, because of the gravity. It's going to change us physically, and allowing that. Now, that leads me to my next book.
Bring it.
By our buddy, Dr. Michael P. Masters, The Extraterrestrial Model. This one, I don't have anything highlighted. It's still in good condition, because the reason is I ordered it before Michael came on the podcast, and Amazon screwed up my delivery, so the book came in after the interview. But I got it on audio on, I think it was Kindle, and he reads it.
There's an audiobook. He read the audiobook.
He read the audiobook, right? Fantastic. And he's got quite a nice voice, so it's quite soothing to listen to. If you're into ASMR, he's got a great ASMR voice. But he brings a really good, you know, because he's a professor of anthropology, and he's been studying just human evolution and how we're progressing. And he makes a very valid point about the fact that some of these aliens might be us from the future. And he mentions several cases, including Willie Strieber, that a lot of people on board of these ships always see humans with aliens, or there's like somebody clad in military armor that's off to the room watching the experiment, or you wake up, there's a, you know, several people. Even he mentions about Travis Walton, when they brought him out of the craft that he was in into the big mothership that he was in, they brought him to a place where everybody was just sitting a bunch of humans were sitting just sort of immobile. Again, hearing those stories scare the shit out of me. It's like, why? Why are they in like this status that are they even aware that they've been taken? That creeps me out. But even our evolution, he talks about how we're changing, our bodies are changing, our faces are shrinking. Our jawline is, this is why we have wisdom teeth. And like in my case, our teeth are crooked because there's no room in the mouth left for our teeth. You've never seen an old skull with the teeth crooked, right? Mm. They never had crooked teeth. They had enough space in their mouths, but our mouths are shrinking and we're getting a smaller jaw. Faces is starting to droop downwards. Our heads will seem big, which, you know, and you continue down the line. You say, okay, well, how many, you know, let's say 100,000 years. Technology such as our phone and stuff like that will be embedded in us. Our eyes will be the same as like Google Lens, you know, or the glasses that they have. It will just, you know, for these guys, that might be how their eyes work, is that they get all this information like in these contact lenses or whatever it is. So he brings really good argument to the fact that it might be us from the future. And he has many cases that he basically gives insight to, the saying that, hey, this is well worth looking into. Because nobody's really talking about. Some people are. Some people have the same theory, but he's really pushing that. He's got three books now. I think his third book just came out. It's fiction. We're supposed to have it on soon, and we're going to talk to him about his newest book.
Yeah, I think mid-October, I think we're having him back on.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Michael's a blast, and he's very smart. But he's such a just a cool guy to hang out with. He's so awesome. But yeah, those are my book recommendations for today of where at least, you know, if you want to add to your library somewhere. And I'm talking to the listeners as well. It's just, they're great ideas. And we should probably, and I know we say this and I'm bad at it, but we should add the links to the books, or at least mention the books and the titles in our description. I'm horrible at that.
In the description.
Yeah. But, yeah, man, it's great. And American Cosmic, like, I have to read that. You've recommended it many times now.
I am determined to get Diana on the show. She is literally the hardest academic I've had to get in touch with in my entire life. Academics are usually fairly easy to get to talk to. You just tell them you like their book, and we're all so starved for any affirmation that we reply. But she's gotten a lot of affirmation, I think. She's been very difficult to get, but I'm doggedly determined to get her on the show.
Like Liam Neeson focused, right?
Yeah. Coming after
her.
Just driving up there? I mean, she lives like 4.5 hours from me. I could just take a day and go to her office and be like,
that's commitment, though. That's commitment.
But
yeah.
That might get me maced or bear sprayed or something. So I want to avoid that. But yeah, I loved your book recommendations. I have to read Bob Lazar's book.
Definitely should be
an obligation,
whether or not you agree with them.
I don't know until I read it, you know. But I would love to know, for our listeners down in the comments, what book should we be reading? What are you reading? What did we leave off that we should read and then come back to and cover in a subsequent video? Like, add to my library, please.
And that's the great thing about our listeners. We don't really have trolls, right? We have really intelligent people, and like people from NASA, Defense Department. They might be able to lead us to some great literature, even articles that we might not know. As always, we always put out the invitation that if you are a researcher, you're part of the, you know, somebody along the lines of David Grush, and you want to come out, you want to talk about it, the podcast is always open to you guys. Just reach out. Like I said, we relaunched everything, so I'm a lot more on the ball with my bookings and stuff like that. I had personal issues I had to deal with before, but we're back on track to studying this phenomenon. And before I leave, just for the listeners, I want to say, because of everything that's been taking place, all the information, plethora of different information coming out, take time to reflect on what's coming out and to think about it. I know it's very reactionary to go to Twitter and make a comment or take something that somebody said literally without thinking about it. And I think that lands us in trouble, especially in the podcasting world. Everybody wants to be first or put out an episode on the newest thing. And I understand that, but we will fall into traps. And we got to keep in mind that the people that have been keeping this secret, they know what they're doing. You know, manipulation of the media and the information. There's some truth, some lies, keep us all confused. So taking time to reflect on what's coming out, really doing a thorough search. I know, Michael, you've been working on the NASA, or you've been looking at the NASA's recent discoveries in UAPs, which I think is a joke. Like,
yeah, the NASA report. Yeah.
We don't know what UAPs are, but we could definitely say they're not alien. How the fuck does that work? Like, how do you know they're not alien, but you don't know what they are? Like, oh, I can't even right now. But yeah, that's just what I want to say, is just take time to reflect. Part of this, you know, especially for UAP studies, is to take a moment. We don't need to be first. We just need to study it correctly. Being first is kind of like rushing to your homework. It's not going to be good. You're not going to get an A. You'll get a C, or, you know, B minus at best. That's not the way we should do research as investigators or people interested in the subject. So that's all I have to say to the listeners. Just, you know, be cautious about the information, even the information on this podcast. You know, the universe is objective. The way we look at things are subjective. We need to meet in the middle somewhere. But that's basically all I had to say for regarding that today. I'm not preachy, but I had to say
it. Advice: no knee-jerk reactions. I agree. I think knee-jerk reactions and not taking the time to process information is leads to fueling the very fire that you are raging against, right?
And you'll have different opinions and stuff like that, but it's just not, you know, Camp Greer and then Camp, you know, Corbell, and like everybody's sort of picking their camps on this issue, and we can't do that. It's the podcast has always been neutral, and we believe in that strongly, that this is a neutral issue. There's no all-stars. You know, if we have Jeremy Corbell on, it's the same as when we have somebody who hasn't been heard of before. Everybody gets a voice, right?
Sure.
Yeah, it's great. So, Michael, thank you so much. I had a blast, man. Like, just we should do this more often. The book.
Same. I think we will. Maybe it'll be a regular bit, depending on how the listeners like it.
Yeah, absolutely. We are going to be working on Patreon stuff. I know that there is the new documentary by Steven Spielberg that's coming out. So we're going to be streaming that, and we're going to be posting it on Patreon, just our actual reactions to the show as we're watching it together with the audience. I would highly suggest people to look us up on Patreon. Like I mentioned, we're going to be on YouTube again, a different branding, and I think we're going to work on Apple and Rumble and all that. We're going to try to be everywhere, like herpes, right? Just everywhere.
At least one third of the population.
Yeah, exactly. But no, I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a good end of this year, I think, and just get more people on board and support those who are speaking out, guys. That's the most important part. Reach out to Ross Coulthart, see how he's doing. Make sure the men in black are not after him, because he's been quiet lately. And just support people that are out there. You know, that's all we need, is just the support to continue doing what we're doing.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad to be doing it with you, man. And thanks for the listeners for tuning in. And I really do look forward to hearing your recommendations in the comments.